exact carrier frequency. And you put it in the lower sideband mode, and the carrier frequency stays the same, but you're now transmitting on the lower side of that carrier. So the center frequency of where you're really listening literally moves when you go from the upper sideband mode to the lower sideband mode. If you are listening to a guy who's transmitting upper sideband on this receiver I just described, and you go to the lower sideband mode, you hear nothing. Go over to brand B, and they flip the oscillator back and forth in frequency so that the center of the audio channel when you're listening stays constant, but the carrier that you would transmit goes up and down as you go from upper sideband mode to lower sideband mode. Some guys set it up that way. A third way of doing it is that when you go to the CW mode, is the frequency that you transmit really where it would have been in the sideband mode, or is it some other place? When you go to the CW mode, you're not tuning your local oscillator of your receiver to be identical to the local oscillator of the guy doing the single sideband transmission, but they set things off in such a way so that you now hear a particular tone. If you did the first example I gave of the sideband mode in the Morse code mode, when you go to receive in sideband, you would hear nothing. You'd be zero beat on the guy's tone, so to speak. So various manufacturers offset some amount, like 600 hertz, you hear a 600 hertz tone. So what you're going to have to do, and it's not an easy one, but it's a fun experiment, either find out, because the Kenwood TS-940, I think you said, that's a very well-known 940S, very well-known Kenwood receiver, transceiver, and so somebody out there has documented all this. But even so, I still want to do it with my particular unit that I own by taking a second transmitter or a second tone that you're listening to, listen to WWV or whatever, and put it into the CW mode, the upper sideband mode, the lower sideband mode,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
With enough experimentation, you'll find out what are the offsets for your particular rig. You also have the RIT function, and whether or not that is zeroed is another function. Some people will intentionally offset the RIT in a particular manner so that they know what's going to happen when they flip from the upper sideband mode to the CW mode so that they can transmit Morse code with the key that's in front of them. So it's something you got to get used to with your particular receiver. Because you probably have installed the auxiliary high-quality filters for the CW mode, and maybe you've got one that's either 500 hertz or 250 hertz wide, not knowing where you have moved really aggravates the problem, and you can easily lose a signal. There's a zillion guys out there who on a 10 gig sideband contact, while they're operating sideband, and Mr. A is talking to Mr. B, and they finish their conversation during a contest, Mr. C comes along and breaks in with Morse code. And if he's smart enough, he will set the carrier he is transmitting such that it comes out in the middle of the audio passband of the sideband receivers that of Mr. A and Mr. B, so that they both hear him. But then Mr. A decides to answer Mr. C, and he goes to the CW mode. His rig goes to some crazy offset, and Mr. C doesn't hear anything anymore and assumes he wasn't getting a response. Very common problem. You're going to have to study your particular rig to find out how it does its offsets, Glenn. And it's a good thing to know. When you find out, don't keep that light under a bushel basket. This is not a dumb question. This is a serious question that a lot of guys have run into. Come back and tell us what you find out. KC2QIQ, K2LIW and the Tech Man.
Oh, why all this headache?
Okay, we only had a quadruple on that one. Alex first, you won out. Go ahead, Alex.
Wow, I worn out. Great. Why all of this headache? Why do they transmit on single sideband CW? That doesn't make sense.
My point.
Okay. Glenn, if you were designing the rig, tell me how you would set it in such a way that when you're in a sideband CISO and somebody breaks in with Morse code, he's a weak guy, he knows he's got to send Morse code, you're not going to hear him, he's smart enough to offset his transmitting frequency such that he falls in the middle of the audio passband you're listening to in the sideband mode. He called KCQQIQ, and KCQQIQ, who was in the sideband mode, wants to now flip his rig to the CW mode so that the Morse code T is activated. What frequency would you like your rig, you haven't touched the dial, what frequency would you like your rig to transmit on? Over to you, Glenn.
Plus 1 kilohertz. Make the simple way is that.
Yes, Dick, exactly. One kilohertz. Not only that, I guess the part that confuses me the most is my original transceiver. I guess it's what you get used to using on sideband CW. The filters were selectable. In other words, on the front panel, you could go from 250, 500, 1.5, 2.5, and 6 kilohertz. You could actually change the filters manually on the front. That's wideband receiving when you're in sideband, and then when you go out and listen to CW, you can narrow it up to CW. The sideband, the CW position is what automatically has the narrow filter. In other words, there's an filter adjustment on the front panel. As you switch modes, it switches different filters. So in other words, I can't be inside vice versa being CW and go to a 2.5 kilohertz filter. Does that make sense, Dick? It's kind of ominous theme here between the two radios.
I have the answer to what they have done in the new radio to KCKY.
Yeah, I hope this is a programmable function, because the guys who are using a HF receiver as a tunable IF on their VHF, UHF, and SHF tunable IF down converters are really plagued with this one. So what do you believe is the glamour fix on this one, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW in the second half.
Okay, on the newer radios, I got a few newer radios. What they have come out with is what they call this tone locate system. So I listen, usually I'll listen, let's say I'm listening to, say, 20 meters CW, and I'm listening in the upper sideband mode just so I can go really quick across, you know, to pick out a station. And then I will go push the CW button. And if I want to get right on that, exactly on to the CW station, because a lot of them are running with a very narrow filter, you push this tone locate button, and then you move the VFO slowly until you hear it beep down. It's like the old, using like an old VFO, a separate VFO system, you know, where you do actually feed on to the signal, and so you hear it like sort of, you know, beat down to it. And with the tone locate, then all, once you've got that, usually you're right on that person, right in the center of that person's bandwidth filter. This is the way it's done in the modern radios. Collins and all, I have the Collins S-line, he's done on CW. Much easier with mechanical filter methods that they use. This is basically what you do. You tune in a little lower down, and put tone on, and you will locate them almost immediately, Dick, over.
Yeah, but let me show you a problem that even with what you described, it may not be an ideal solution, Mel. Assume now that in the CW portion of the 20-meter band at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Saturday, the band is open and everything is hopping, and you're hearing in your 2KC bandwidth, you're hearing 15 separate Morse code signals. And the weak one that's in those 15 is the DX station you're looking for. So there's a weak one in 15 other stations. And I've been listening in the sideband mode. To me, the only way that has any sense is that when I flip from the sideband mode to the CW mode, the weak guy I'm listening to better be on the exact same tone, or I'm going to lose him. He's a weak one buried in 15 other Morse code guys that are pounding away, and they're potent. So if there's any shift in tone, I've lost him. But now, even if the tone stays the same, and now I'm about to transmit to him on his exact frequency, in order for me to hear his tone, my carrier, so to speak, is offset, let's say, 600 hertz. So I heard a 600 hertz tone. But now when I go to the CW transmit mode, that 600 hertz offset has to be taken back out, otherwise the digital display on my screen is not telling me the real frequency I'm on. I think you see a little bit about what I'm getting at here. If there's any shift in tone when I change modes, I'm going to lose that guy under the heat of battle. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Exactly. That's why you've got to be precisely on him. Most of them will run with a very narrow filter. And unless they're running split, you better be precisely on them by turning on a tone and then tuning. You've got to tune slow. This is the situation. I have to dial, you know, you can set the dial for speed of the tuning. In other words, I can run literally right across the band in one position, and then I can tune extremely slow. I set that to extremely slow tuning at that point. Push the button on that. You got a lot of buttons on these radios. I got this one radio, this new Yaesu. It's got 80-some-odd controls on the front panel. You really got to get yourself familiarized with it. But once you learn how to use that tone, and you tune with it in the slow position, and you get that down to that beat, you're right precisely on them, and that's one of the secrets of working these stations, because they are listening on a very narrow filter thing. Otherwise, if they know, if there's a QRM problem in the pile-ups and all, many times this is the situation, over.
Okay, I'm looking at the display now of my old-fashioned, ancient TS-711A 2-meter all-mode rig. And my display, I'm going to ignore the red labels, which are telling me I'm in the transmit mode, I'm on the A memory, I'm in the DFO mode, and in the green display, it's telling me on the lower left-hand corner, I'm on memory number 3, it's giving me the exact frequency. On the right-hand side are some digits telling me where my RIT, my receiver incremental tuning, is set. If I'm smart enough and using my RIT correctly, I think I can make this all come out right where, number one, when I turn the RIT on and off at the right time, as I flip from sideband mode to the CW mode, and I've got that RIT properly set, I believe I can have the glamour where the tone of this weak guy I'm listening to does not shift, so I don't lose him as far as the human operator is concerned. But then when I start transmitting, I'll be directly on him, I believe, if I properly use RIT, or in some rigs there's also a transmitter incremental tuning. But I think the receiver incremental tuning can make it come out right. Am I wrong on that one, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW?
Okay. The new radios, first of all, you can't transmit CW without pushing the CW button. In other words, you can't key it. It will not, the internal key will not work. If it's in one of the sideband positions, or the AM position, or the packet, or the rear, you know, they have a whole bunch of buttons on the front now. All the different builds, everything's built into the high-end radios. Now, it does have RIT, which you have a button that says RIT receive, RIT transmit. So, in other words, you can run the RIT either or, even for receiving or for transmitting. And yet, that way you can sometimes, you can play with it and offset it. You got the notch, you got a whole bunch of things to do with that, with the different options now. But the point is that if you're going to, you know, mess with the RIT, make sure first that you're on the transmit set. If you want to play with the RIT receive, that's another thing. But remember, it's not going to work. Not going to send CW, the keyer will not switch on unless you have it in CW position, which switches both receiver and transmitter over.
Comment. Person with comment, give us your call and name if you haven't already done so.
Hi, Dick. This is KO2OK, Bennett. I will say on some radios, I have a 756 ICOM radio. If it has in its option menu, single sideband / CW synchronous tuning, it's meant specifically for that purpose. You can be in sideband mode listening to a CW station, flip over to CW mode, and it'll stay at the same frequency. You won't have lost anything. That's on some radios, not all radios, but that's another option some radios have. Back to you.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is you've got to study this, and it's a continuous place of contention among the serious UHF and SHF operators. I hear this complaint during every single contest. And so many times I just sit and listen, and I hear guys calling each other, and in some cases they're using a drifting rig, and they're using either their main tuning dial or the RIT dial, and they're slowly walking across the band as they go back and forth. There's a lot of grief on this particular one, Glenn. You brought up a subject where you've got to study it on your particular rig by using another transmitter or another source of signal. You really got to use another rig, another transceiver, and go back and forth between transmitting on one into a dummy load, listening on the other, and vice versa, in order to find out what really happened to the transmit frequency and receive frequency of your particular rig when you flip it between these modes. And there isn't a universality. Each manufacturer thinks they've got it knocked. They think they've made it most user-friendly, or they've completely ignored the problem. And many of the VHF, UHF amateurs out there are gnashing a lot of teeth over this exact problem. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the deck nest.
K2RIW, KC2QIQ. Dick, am I making the next side with my HD?
You're a little noisy, but you're making it. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I have to step outside for a minute, but the second part of my question is, if you look at the band plane from the AWRL, and they talk about certain detection carriers sending, Morse code side tone at 1 kHz, is that a legitimate thing, or are you really supposed to be in the CW mode and receive a portion for Morse?
Okay, you think you've got one question there. There's almost a double question there, Glenn. In the CW portion, if you really are following the band plan, my understanding is you transmit nothing but CW. In the sideband portion of the band, within reason, at least on the higher bands where they're not super crowded, in the sideband portion, you can send CW. You can be in the sideband portion of the 10 gig band, and two guys are talking back and forth in sideband. You know you're weak, but you want to break in, and you transmit Morse code to them in the middle of their audio passband. There's something about the human hearing system that when it hears a weak tone in the noise, the signal can be quite a few dB below threshold, and you'll hear it. Whereas that guy is smart enough to know that he's a free power transmitter, he's a long distance away, he knows if he transmits sideband, you're not going to hear him. So at least when it comes to the VHF contest, perfectly legal to transmit CW in the sideband portion. But to my knowledge, vice versa is essentially verboten. You transmit sideband in a CW portion of the band, and you're going to get a lot of guys mad at you. That's what I believe it is. Back to you, Glenn.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Dick. Quite a number of times, I'd say maybe a half a dozen times over the years, I've had a guy at a walking phone on, let's say, 20 meters, and he'll say, I need your prefix on CW. Can we go to CW? And I'll say, sure. And right then and there, right in that very spot on the phone portion of the band, we'll do a CW. So, this way he gets a confirmation for that as well. Back to you, Dick.
I agree with you, Paul. I think for passing a specific piece of information, locator, grid square, signal report, QTH, and things like that, name, to my knowledge, there is almost no portion of any ham band where Morse code is not perfectly allowed, legal, acceptable, whatever. Morse code, I think you can use almost anywhere, except on an FM repeater. But sideband, there are specific regions where you can use sideband. There are specific regions where you can use flow scan television and digital modes and so on. So I think you can use Morse code almost anywhere, particularly for transmitting a particular key piece of information. KT2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, no, very good, Dick. The only thing that I get strictly is a little strange to is that listening to CW portion, I think, is a totally different statistical on that specific CSI. I get the CW, the upper sideband, and the lower sideband. I can tell that they're on sideband proper to respond to them. So I would think that unless I'm responding to them in CW mode, if they can still hear me.
There's a bit of an ambiguity here now, Glenn. A guy who is using a rig in the single sideband mode, and he is transmitting a tone into what used to be the microphone circuit. Let's say, for instance, a 600 hertz or a 1KC tone, and he's turning that tone on and off. Because most of our sideband rigs have a finite amount of carrier rejection in the transmit mode, and because the hold-on rig, so to speak, is not being turned on and off on each key pressing and release, you really are transmitting in two different portions of the band. You're transmitting a carrier that's 30 dB down continuously, and you're transmitting Morse code that's going on and off as you turn on this audio oscillator, and depending on the way the automatic gain control or the automatic level control is working in your rig, you may hear some noise coming from the audio amplifier circuit during the key-up mode. So a sideband rig to transmit what is essentially modulated audio, so to speak, is not really the preferred way to do it, in my opinion. So people have done it in a pinch, but if you do it all the time, I think particularly the people who live close to you, which are hearing the noise of your ALC circuit, they're hearing the carrier that you're transmitting continuously, and they're hearing the tone that's going on and off, they're not going to be too happy with you. To do it for a short period of time as an experiment, great. But to continuously operate that way, I think you're going to make some enemies. I may be misunderstanding you, but that's another subject worth sort of discussing, in my opinion. How are you, Glenn?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Dick. I was listening around the band, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, wait, this is definitely the piece, but it was definitely, I would think that somehow they were using some kind of an external, you know, DW key or that has the capability of microphone or something, because, like you said, it was definitely a sideband signal, and I'm listening to it, and, you know, it wasn't just one operator. There were a few of them in there, and I was like, wow. And that's why I'm starting to think to myself, wait, no, this is supposed to be in CW mode. But, you know, here again, I haven't really been in the CW. That's why I kind of wanted to throw this out there. You know, because to me, like you said, it's really for sideband in the CW portion. I just wondered, you know, if people are just viewing it today as Morse code, sending the difference between the CW and the SSC, or maybe it was just my confusion. But from what you're saying, clarifying what I'm thinking, that CW is CW. That's the CW position, and you send it directly on the key, and that's basically it, you know, in those portions of the band. Thanks for clarifying that, Dick. K2RIW, K2QIQ.
K2KY, I'll tell you how this is happening, Dick.
Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Mel in a second. A real CW operator of high quality transmits nothing but that particular frequency, turned on and turned off as he presses down the key and releases, and nothing else is being transmitted when he's keyed up. And when he's keyed down, only that exact frequency and nothing else is being transmitted. A guy who is not properly setting up his equipment, and there's one step further than this. Occasionally I've heard a guy transmit CW by way of single sideband mode and a code practice oscillator that's operating somewhere else in the room. So he's coming into his microphone with all of the room reflections and the noises in the background of people talking in his house, and the television set running in the background, and the children crying, and the dog barking. You hear all of that, and you hear this Morse code oscillator, a code practice oscillator, transmitting audio into the room, reflecting off everything in the room, and eventually some of it getting into the microphone, and he's transmitting that as Morse code. That's really low quality. You do that among well-informed operators, and you're going to make yourself very unpopular real fast. Do it temporarily as some kind of a test, maybe once or twice. You do that day after day, and a lot of people are going to get unhappy with you. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly. This is K2KEY. This MCW is not legal. And how it came about, there was a couple of rigs that were put out. You could actually send Morse code with a microphone. They had a button, two buttons on the top of the microphone, and you could use them for keying the rig. And, you know, these people think that they're so ignorant of, they are actually ignorant of law, because I told a couple of them, it's not legal what you're doing. Well, why not? It's CW, I just put it, not classically the CW, the FCC authorized. You're doing MCW, and it's not authorized in the HF band. And a few of my friends, in fact, they said, oh, you can't make really contact on CW. And the reason was they did not know how to use the radio properly on CW. And when I showed it to them, I said, these people are all running on busy times, like you said. They're running narrow filters on their receivers. And if you don't get right on the point where you're supposed to be, for them to hear you in that filter, you're not going to make the contact. And if you're, you know, used to, like I say, just tuning single sideband, and then all of a sudden you go over to CW, it is a different experience. So you've got to, like I say, understand the radio. And it's not like in the old days, you know, when we were novices, that you may call somebody that 20 kilohertz higher or lower from your one crystal frequency, you know, everybody tuned around it. Those days are gone, Dick, over.
Absolutely. A good buddy of mine was on top of Mount Wachusett in Massachusetts during a 10-gig contest and suddenly discovered to his horror that he had arrived on station with all of his jumper cables and test equipment and transmitters and receivers and dish aiming circuitry. And he brought everything. He got the darn Morse code key. And he wanted to get on Morse code in the worst way. And he had no way of generating a tone. He whistled into his microphone at approximately a 1KC rate, and he operated the push-to-talk switch, and it sounded a little bit like this. Real yucky-sounding stuff. But he did make the contact. But that's, on 10 gigs, you can get away with that. You do that on 20 meters, and boy, they're going to come gunning for you. Over to you, Glenn.
Actually, Dick, your CQ there actually came out pretty good. But, yeah, it was kind of interesting because I was tuning around on the band today, to, you know, just practicing my copy and listening to QSOs. It was driving me crazy with that radio. Normally, I could get away with copying the, you know, the Morse code in sideband with the break. It's so much easier, but with the using that TS-940F, I'm in CW, and all of a sudden noticing it's kind of quiet. Then I go inside, and I'm hearing a few stations, and I'm looking at the section, and I'm like, hey, this is the CW only for it. Right band plan here? I don't know. I guess it's more prevalent. I don't know, Mel, maybe you have a comment. Have you noticed that there are a lot of people using sideband, you know, Morse code and the CW portion of the band? It's something I just kind of noticed today, but maybe it was just, you know, something out of the blue today that was unusual.
Major Boy, while checking in.
Joe recognized, and Mel, that was a turnover to you.
Next advice to station, check in. Yeah, I noticed lately, it's ignorance, a lot of ignorance among some of the new hands. In fact, when I had a couple of contacts with a few of them, and I told them certain things they were doing actually were illegal, that they thought. In fact, one guy actually said to me, I didn't know it makes a difference that you can call a CW station with sideband if you hear them, you know, the down, and just you hear them, that doesn't make a difference. I thought that just people that were running CW, that was the only way they could operate, or for some reason, that it's really, I said, there is a separation. And the confusion was, like you say, that you can operate CW into the sideband portion of the band, but you can't operate the sideband in the CW portion of the band. A lot of hams seem to get that very confused, Dick, over.
And my goodness, do they. And among gentlemen's agreements and almost by FCC rule, well, FCC doesn't dictate our band plans. It's a gentleman's agreement, but some of the gentlemen's agreement band plans have been around, established for such a long period of time. They're really cut in granite, and you violate those granite laws, and you're going to be unpopular real fast. I don't recommend you do that. I think we've answered all of the sign-in verbal questions of the people who signed in tonight. However, there may be some new people with some new verbal questions, or I may have skipped some people with my error, or some of the people who did sign in, who thought they had no question, now do have a question. Here's your opportunity. Give me your call letters and name right now. KQLAW.
KC2MDP.
MDP recognized. Anyone else?
Base Warrior White Joe. Question.
Steve and Joe in that order. Anyone else? Steve, you got the floor.
Thank you very much, Dick. I got a little bit of updated information on that transformer. I don't have the transformer with me, but I went to the website. And Mel was right. It is in kilohertz, at least. That's what's stamped on the transformer they have in the picture of the website. So it's 25 kilohertz instead of 25 hertz, which I would imagine would shed a whole new light on ball game. I'm actually Dick. Fluke, Dick, the fluke meter, the average fluke, only goes up to 2 kilohertz in measuring, over.
D-U-D. Okay. So it's a little bit like the electronic ballast for fluorescent lighting. They run at much higher frequencies. And so, too bad the fluke meter won't go beyond. And in a way, I can sort of see why. Because in the AC mode, a meter is usually used to measure 50 hertz or 60 hertz signal, depending on whether you're in Europe or the United States. And so anything beyond 2 kilohertz might possibly represent noise on the circuit, which would give you extra error. So they got a low-pass filter in there. Is a guess on my part. Joe, what would you like to talk about tonight? You got it. KQLIW.
Something I hope you have the answer for.
Okay. We're ready for your question, Joe.
Okay. This is actually a problem I just got with one of the receivers I have, and I never knew I had this problem before. They're looking for something else and just have an accident and discover it. I was with multi-mode, all over the place type of receiver, and I think you own one of these things too. I'm using it with a disc cone antenna, and at my location I also have several other antennas for other various devices hooked up, including one for a repeater that runs approximately 448 megahertz. When that repeater is operating and transmitting, and it's about a 100-watt repeater into a 7.5 dB station master, the two antennas are about maybe 25 feet apart, all right? And I would estimate the signal level coming in is probably 0 to plus 10 coming down the monitor antenna, because, it's fairly strong. I didn't measure that with an analyzer to actually know that exact level. Here's the problem with what happens. When the R7000 is turned on and connected to an antenna, there's no other emissions coming out of it that I could see looking at another device through a duplexer elsewhere in the lower part of the band around 433 megahertz. If I turn the R7000 off, I get an interference around 433.15 to 433.25. It's FM modulated with 60 hertz. And it varies in frequency. Now, here's the kicker. If I pull the AC cord out of the R7000, the interference still persists. If I disconnect the antenna from the R7000, the interference goes away.
Yeah, it's called PIMP, passive intermodulation distortion. And there's a zillion ways you can do it. A receiver front end, when the receiver is active, the very first amplification stage is a Class A amplifier. Drawing current continuously represents a quasi-linear load on the antenna on which it is receiving. Turn the R7000 off, really off, and now that first stage of amplification, if it was a bipolar transistor, you're looking into an emitter-based junction, which is a rectifying diode. You put any kind of a diode onto any kind of an antenna that's in the vicinity of a transmitter where the total signal getting into that diode is, I'm going to pick a number, in the vicinity of 0 dBm or stronger. You've now turned the diode on and off in each half cycle of that RF. That diode is by definition a very nonlinear load. If there's any possibility of more than one signal in the environment, that diode will mix all of those signals together into every possible combination of intermodulation distortion. It's called the M by N product. Mike, by November product, where Mike and November are integers. 1 by 2, 2 by 3, 3 by 1, 4 by 2, and so on. Every possible combination. In other words, that diode is making every possible harmonic of frequency 1, every possible harmonic of frequency 2, every possible combination of all of those. On a real good spectrum analyzer, you will see all of those products. Only thing left to discuss is how strong are they? Are they above the threshold of the other receiving equipment that's in the vicinity? So you're now double proving why every single transmitter at a multi... Let me drop. If I've got a real good location, the top of a building somewhere, like say for instance the Wind Watch in Hampod, and a whole lot of individual transmitters are located there, repeater sites. Every single one of those transmitters must have a circulator in the output, because there's nothing more non-linear in this world than the final stage of a Class C transmitter, or any transmitter at all, but certainly a Class C transmitter that's running FM. The output of that transmitter, when that transmitter is on the air, is a beautiful non-linear device that'll take all of the frequencies on that site, mix them together in all combinations. So in the worst case scenario, and I'm a little bit off to one side of what you're talking about, a service person comes along, he was told you will get 50 watts out of that transmitter. You will tweak it until you get 50 watts. And he's got 48. And he discovers if he removes the circulator, hey, I just took out half a dB of loss, I'm now up to 51 watts, I'm meeting spec. He puts the circulator in his pocket, he puts everything back together, and he walks out. Oh boy, can he create problems. I'm sure you've heard of that one. So the transmitter is the one you've heard about a lot in the past. It's hard to believe a receiver can do that. But if you look at the emitter base junction of that first transistor, and you look at it as a diode when it's not turned on, you'll see how it can do it. Back to you, Joe, K2LIW.
Okay, that's easy to accept, that explanation. But the demodulated emissions that I see on another, through another antenna and another duplex that gives me some filtering, which is another transmitter receiver combination, it sees this interfering signal wander in frequency. It starts at, like I said, 433.15 and can go as high as 433.25, and it seems to be FM modulated at over 20 kilohertz of deviation with a 60 hertz tone rate.
That sounds like someone's pre-running oscillator somewhere in the neighborhood. I know that when there used to be a guy running a scanner receiver in my neighborhood, boy, I would hear all kinds of things drifting through my various receivers. It's going to take a more thorough search with a good spectrum analyzer and a good antenna, turning on and off various pieces of the combination to find out where it's coming from. There's a slim possibility it's coming from your shack, your equipment, or somebody else's equipment. In the worst case scenario, the equipment causing the grief could be a mile away. So the kinds of interference you're discussing at times are really tough to search down. And until you hit the right combination, you're thinking to yourself, hey, this is impossible. This can't be happening. Now back to you, Joe.
Okay, the emission I'm talking about all is coming out of the R7000 receiver, because it completely goes away if I either turn off the repeater transmitter, which is producing about 100 watts out, 80 watts out of the duplexer. If I turn that off, it goes away. Or if I disconnect the disc cone antenna to the R7000, it also goes away. If I turn the R7000 on and power it up, or put the line cord in when it's, the line was. If it's powered up, I get no interference whatsoever. If it's that's the cases. I could see it producing interference, but why is it modulated?
Okay, the word on and off is a very relative word. It's obvious when you turn your television set off, it's not really off, because you can pick up the remote control, which is usually an infrared transmitter, and so a power supply in your television set, usually also the audio amplifier, runs continuously. You might say, why in the world did they do that? Well, every time you turn on the television set, if the audio amplifier is turned on and you've got a real good speaker system, you're going to hear a pop come out of those speakers as that audio amplifier is suddenly being powered. to avoid that pop, the audio amplifier runs continuously. One of the corollaries to this is a guy will say, gee, I've got my television set thoroughly turned off, and when the guy next door turns on his Citizens Band transmitter, I hear his audio coming out of my loudspeakers. Well, his audio amplifier is active, and some stage somewhere is rectifying and amplifying it and passing it through to the loudspeaker. So the word off is a relative word, and you're discovering that as you unplug the plug on a R7000 that on the front panel has been turned off. Some power supply in there is turned on. There is a way with the R7000, depending on which option you've got, where you can remotely control it with an infrared device. So I'll bet you when you investigate further, you're going to find out that one of the power supplies and some of the circuits inside that R7000 remain active when the front panel is turned off. That's a guess on my part. Back to you, Joe.
Okay, let me clarify this, okay? When the R7000 is turned on and receiving a signal, or just the front panel's lit up and it's doing something, there is no interference being produced. If you turn the R7000 off or remove the line cord, then it produces interference. If you disconnect the antenna to the receiver, it produces no interference.
Okay, so a R7000 with the line cord unplugged is certainly off, except for the Keep Alive battery, the watch battery. What is that called? There's a mercury battery, not mercury, what is it nowadays? But you know what I mean. There's a lithium battery in there that keeps some of the memory active. I don't think so, but it's possible he does something. The other possibility is the R7000 turned off, but antenna connected is acting as a mixing device. And there's some other oscillator somewhere around that you wouldn't ordinarily hear unless you had a local mixer. It would be interesting to take that antenna that you plug into the R7000, where you hear this mysterious signal, instead of plugging into the R7000, choose a few other pieces of equipment in the house that you can plug it into that are turned off. Or put a real 1-in-21 diode across the contact of that antenna connector that went to the R7000. Put a real Schottky diode there and see if the interference returns. In which case, you'll confirm my guess that it could be the emitter base junction acting as a mixing diode on the front end of the R7000. By the way, also, when you're connected to the R7000, press that button on the front panel. You'll have to do it by turning it on, called attenuator. When you plug in that attenuator, when it's on, you don't get the effect. And I don't think you can command that attenuator when it's off. Now, you don't have that option. The next thing to do, to really pin it down, when you plug into the R7000 and you measure the amplitude of the squittering signal, plug a 3, 6, 10 dB attenuator between that antenna connector and the R7000. If the signal is really being emitted by the R7000, it will follow the attenuator. Plug in 3 dB of attenuation, the offending signal will go down by exactly 3 dB if the R7000 is producing it. If the R7000 is making it as an intermod, plugging in 3 dB of attenuation will lower the amplitude of the offending signal by 6 or 9 or 12 dB. Intermods follow a different set of rules that are nonlinear. Plug in some attenuation on that connector to the R7000 and measure the amplitude of the offending signal. That could be a fun experiment. And let us know what you find, Joseph, KQRIW.
Okay, I've heard of that that type of test before. I could certainly do that to see if it's truly being emitted by the R7000. But it still goes back to the basic question. Why am I seeing an interference being produced that has 20 kilohertz of deviation at a 60 hertz rate? What in there could be producing that? Certainly wouldn't be the watch battery that runs the microprocessor memory backup.
The wording of that question says just that you believe is really being emitted by the R7000. We haven't proven that yet. When you plug in a 3 dB pad and it goes down more than 3 dB, it will suggest that it's not created by the R7000 directly is created by the R7000 indirectly as a mixing diode. That attenuator test is going to give you a lot of information. Do it with a couple of different values of attenuator just to be sure. If you find out that the ascending signal goes down by a much larger number of dB than the attenuator you plug into that connector between cable and R7000, if that's true, it strongly suggests R7000 is not directly creating it. Then you're going to have to find out who's really doing it. That's another whole bunch of tests of turning everything else on and off, looking at a good antenna, like for instance your disc cone antenna with a good spectrum analyzer, with a preamplifier on the spectrum analyzer. The spectrum analyzer starts over 30 dB of noise figure, and as you go up to the higher bands, goes to 50 dB of noise figure. So you've got to put a preamplifier in front of the spectrum analyzer or your service monitor. I think the spectrum analyzer in the service monitor also has a fairly high noise figure. You may have to put a preamplifier in it to really see what the local environment is doing. There's a slim possibility there's a local oscillator in some piece of equipment in your next-door neighbor's house, and you don't hear that squittering signal as an intermod unless there's something nonlinear in your system that creates the intermod. Over to you, Joe.
Okay, the signal that this is producing, now this is hooked to a particular device I'm using that I'm looking at, one port of the duplexer, that is attached to a beam, a UHF beam, on the same pole that the disc cone is mounted on. They're about maybe 10 or 12 feet apart vertically, all right? But I will try that attenuator test when I get back to you later on in your tech net if I can break in there. I couldn't come in earlier today because the internet was shut off and I could not get in from the internet connection. But I'll get back to you later. I will try that attenuator. I'll try I have a couple of various level attenuators. I'll try them. I'll write down the results I get.
That's going to be an interesting test. Looking forward to that one, Joe. And right now, I'm voting with 80% probability you're going to discover that the R7000 is not directly generating that signal when it's unplugged. Hard for me to believe that the lithium battery powering the memory circuit could do that. That's about the only thing that I think left running in the R7000 with the 110-volt line plug removed. Unless there's some other accessory you got in there that's got some kind of a UPS to it, which I doubt. Though it could be the remote control. Some of the R7000s have a remote control you can buy that I think works by infrared. Yes, sure enough. In the upper right-hand corner of the R7000, I'm looking at one right now, 2 inches to the left of the upper right-hand corner, there's something called remote, a little bit of a red spot where it's got an infrared receiver that picks up the remote control. And for all we know, there's some kind of a keep-alive circuit in that thing. Okay, I think that we'll see now. I think we went to Steve, we went to Joe. Did I forget anybody up till now? And also, Paul, WS2N, if you're there, and you want to tell us what's going on in space, any of those people, sign in right now, KQRIW. Okay, I did go to a beautiful speech today that took place at noon at Spectra Thin Films, is the name of the company, in Hopog, where one of the professors for the University of Arizona, who works on the BMT project, Big Magellan Telescope, and he gave a description of the construction of that telescope. Wow. The biggest mirror anyone mass produces these days is 8.3 meters in diameter. That's 25-foot diameter mirror for an optical telescope. Can you imagine a project of taking 7 of those mirrors and putting them together as a cluster for the main reflector? That's what the project of the Big Magellan Telescope will be, and it's going to be installed on top of the mountain in Chile. That's a telescope. And it's going to be operational 9 years from now if all goes well. A $500 million project by a consortium of various universities and I think National Science Foundation. That's a telescope with AO, adaptive optics to correct for atmospheric distortion. When it comes to optical astronomy, the ground-based telescopes with adaptive optics characteristics are pretty far exceeding Hubble in capability. Now, Hubble has still got a lot of things that it can do that's unique. It can give you infrared pictures and ultraviolet pictures that you can't get on the ground because the atmosphere is not sufficiently transparent there. But when it comes to the center of the optical band, the ground-based telescopes are doing a better job than the Hubble in resolution and sensitivity. So that discussion took place today from noon till 3 o'clock, I guess it was, and very well attended. They gave you a free meal, a beautiful lecture, and I got a chance to ask as many questions of one of the chief scientists of this project. That's going to be a telescope. Okay, Mel, I guess it's time for you to tell us who has written in questions that you think are worthy of being answered. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, did we stand by for Paul? I know he checked in. Maybe he'd like to give the space report over.
Yeah, I did make a request for Paul. Let me request Paul one more time. WS2N. If you're there, Paul, K2LIW.
Oh, yeah, I'm here, Dick. But no, I didn't have a real space report this week. I didn't see any major changes in the Phoenix program on the Mars lander or any of the missions that we've discussed, you know, such as Spirit and Opportunity. As I heard, they're all doing well. So I really didn't have anything. I'm interested in the Magellan telescope you were talking about. I noticed they just completed one large binocular telescope, and that had three of these mirrors. I think they were 8 meters in diameter as well with the adaptive optics. So you're just saying this one's going to be bigger. Looking forward to it, Dick, and good information on that. I'm sure we'll read plenty more about it, or maybe see some kind of documentary relating to that topic. Eight years, or usually it's a year or so before these things go online, maybe on Channel 13 or something. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
You know, now that I think about it, Paul, I'm disappointed that I didn't think to call you. This was open to the technically interested public. I could have called you. You could have attended. You would have enjoyed it. Yes, the LBT and the GMT were being compared side by side in many of these beautiful slides. And the slides were in three dimensions. They handed out three-dimensional glasses, and you watched these slides and movies in 3D. Beautiful stuff. The large binocular telescope is a pair of 8.3 meter diameter reflecting lenses, parabolic lenses, side by side. And I believe that is operational. It has had first light. I think it's operational for about a year or so. And working very well. They're using that as proof that this next EMT is a worthwhile project. Those 8.3 meter diameter lenses are being fabricated right at University of Arizona, right below the football stadium, is where that work is taking place. And you see the pictures of them casting an 8.3 meter, 25 foot diameter silica glass lens. I mean, the stuff that you and I used to think only could be done at Corning Glass Works are now being done at the University of Arizona. They've got one hell of an astronomy department there, doing some really fantastic work. And now the BMT has one center lens and six lenses around that, all 8.3 meters in diameter. But the six center lenses are all being built to an offset parabolic shape. And all the grinding machinery and whatever is there. Quite a project.
My alma mater.
Okay. Was that taking place while you were there, sir? Go ahead. And who are we talking to here?
Yeah, hi, Dick. It's Dave, N2APG. You know, I was there many years ago, I, in fact, went there for astronomy. Wanted to be an astronomer. But when you're young and naive, you know, you think that going to college for astronomy is going to be looking through telescopes, and they don't tell you that it's all math. And I was not a very good math student, so my astronomy career ended very quickly.
If you Google the word, Dave, if you Google the word BMT or Big Magellan Telescope, you'll find lots and lots of references to this project. Some nice pictures, nice descriptions, letters of intent and whatever between the associated universities that are doing this project. That's going to be a telescope and a half. Put on top of a mountain in Chile. I can't think of the name of the actual mountain now, but it's one of these places where you get an inch of rain per decade type stuff. Really high, dry, thin atmosphere area. Ideal for optical astronomy. So, you ain't seen nothing yet. This telescope is going to be doing some major work when it comes to exoplanet search. How many of those stars out there have a solar system? How many of those solar systems have planets that are in the Goldilocks zone, like the Earth? And eventually we're going to be asking the question, how many of those planets that we are starting to see, we've now found more than 300 planets going around somebody else's sun. How many of them are going to have life? How many of them are going to have intelligent life? The big QSO in the sky, you're going to see that sometime. I wish I could say soon. Sometime. It's going to be a big QSO. You wait and see. Mel, did we get any exobiology questions? K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2KEY. Yeah, well, we get a lot of questions, but a lot of comments also on what we have discussed in the last few weeks. And again, what seems to come up is a lot of questions from young people. And the major question is that why can't, you know, I make any contact on bands like 10, 12, 15, 18 meters and all, and, you know, why does the band, when is it going to open up and all. So questions on propagation, basically. And I don't know what to say, really. There's all kinds of comments been tossed around lately that we're sitting on the bottom of this past 23 cycle, or the bottom of it for 17 months now, and from past history, any time that we sat long periods on the bottom of the previous cycle, the next cycle is usually much faster rising, and but not to any kind of peak of previous cycles. In other words, it's quick up and quick down cycles. Now, you also went on the other drop, and I'll tell you what this also associated with. They had another comment on this. That the sun temperature has been going down, and we are possibly going to look into the near future of a mini ice age again. You believe that the sun's temperature is actually decreasing, Dick, over?
No, I do not. If you saw the PBS program that was repeated a few times during the last 2 weeks, it's a NOVA program called The Dimming of the Sun, or Sun Dimming. What they've discovered is that the amount of global warming is significantly greater than we previously believed, and what is a counteracting force that has been fooling us is the so-called solar dimming. The solar dimming is not because the sun is putting out less illumination. It's because the particles in the pollution that we're pumping into the atmosphere are acting as nucleation sites. Therefore, the clouds that we now make with these fine little particles of pollution are making fine little droplets of water vapor. And let me backtrack on this one. Assume you've got water-laden air, air with slightly high humidity, rising by way of the thermal action of solar illumination on the Earth, It rises to a high enough altitude where the water starts condensing from the vapor form to the liquid form.